I'm Kristen Marchand, and this is the Opiongo Line, a podcast concerned with the unique culture and local heritage found only in the Upper Madawaska and Opiongo River valleys here in Eastern Ontario, Canada. Today, I'm joined by nine members of the Opiongo Readers Theatre: Leslie Betts, Jeff Bowman, Kathy Chepesky, Karen and Rob Filipkowski, Carolyn Brian Peterson, Lynn Stewart, and Mark Wormke. They are all here with their annual Christmas show, this year called A Christmas Carol. No, not that famous short story written by Charles Dickens, but a whole different show, replete with a remarkable handful of classic, if somewhat unfamiliar, short stories mixed in with an equal number of curious, yet largely forgotten, Christmas classic poems. But to be honest, what with the great funk the world seems to be engulfed by these days, it may be hard for some of you to think much about celebrating Christmas. Still, we've searched far and wide and think we've got a surefire tonic for those who might be dangerously headed down towards what Elvis used to caterwaul about, that blue Christmas. We all know it's not likely to be a blue, and maybe not even a white Christmas, if the weather office is to be believed. So let's just sit back, put our feet up, relax, and let the Opiongo Readers Theatre take us on a whirlwind ride towards a very different place and time. Most certainly, the nine ORT members are all here to remind us that, yes, we do have lots to be thankful for, especially in this dark, dreary December. To begin with, they thought we might put you in a proper mood with a very old Christmas carol, in fact, one of the oldest in Canada. Only instead of singing Jean de Brébeuf's famous 17th century Huron carol, we thought we'd recite a brand new version. It was written by Dana Seaborn from Victoria, British Columbia, only 5 years ago. And though it's based on that same 400-year-old tune that Father Brébeuf used, it does a much better job of reflecting the true realities of the Huron, or Wendat Nation. We gather at midwinter dark to share this hallowed night. Within our longhouse, warm and dry, the fire glows with light. Our elders sing a teaching song. It fills the night that seems so long. This is our sacred home neath heaven's dome. Shining stars proclaim the dawn. Sky Woman came down from above, but found no place to stand till Toad put mud on Turtle's back, and that became the land. Sky Woman died in giving birth. Her holy body fed the earth. This is our sacred home neath heaven's dome. Shining stars proclaim the dawn. A valiant little turtle rode a cloud up to the sky. She used the lightning to make fire and made our sun to shine. He journeys neath the world we see, returns to make the shadows flee. This is our sacred home neath heaven's dome. Shining stars proclaim the dawn. The black robes came from lands afar and told us of a day Judea had been colonized and Rome must be obeyed. A mother bore a child of light, rejoicing filled the starlit night. This is our sacred home neath heaven's dome. Shining stars proclaim the dawn. Rejoice, have courage, one and all. The stars shine overhead, the same stars that shone down upon a baby's humble bed. The infant grew to be a man. His words, like stars, light many lands. This is our sacred home neath heaven's dome. Shining stars proclaim the dawn. So, it's on with the show. Here's a short poem, one of our favorites, written during the worst of the American Civil War. It's simply called Christmas Bells, and it was composed by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. It's read by Rob Filipkowski.
I heard the bells on Christmas Day their old familiar carols play, and wild and sweet the words repeat of peace on earth, goodwill to men, and thought how, as the day had come, the belfries of all Christendom had rolled along the unbroken song of peace on earth, goodwill to men, till, ringing, singing on its way, the world revolved from night to day, a voice, a chime, a chant sublime of peace on earth, goodwill to men. Then, from each black accursed mouth, the cannon thundered in the south, and with the sound the carols drowned, of peace on earth, goodwill to men. And in despair I bowed my head. There is no peace on earth, I said, for hate is strong and mocks the song of peace on earth, goodwill to men. Then pealed the bells more loud and deep. God is not dead, nor doth he sleep. The wrong shall fail, the right prevail, with peace on earth, goodwill to men.
Next up, we have Karen Filipkowski reading, again, another short poem, only this time it's called Ring Out Wild Bells, written by Alfred Lord Tennyson around the same time as Longfellow's Christmas Bells. It seems almost to answer his distraught American counterpart.
Ring out, wild bells, to the wild sky, the flying cloud, the frosty light. The year is dying in the night. Ring out, wild bells, and let him die. Ring out the old, ring in the new, ring happy bells across the snow. The year is going, let him go. Ring out the false, ring in the true. Ring out the grief that saps the mind, for those that here we see no more. Ring out the feud of rich and poor, ring in redress to all mankind. Ring out the slowly dying cause and ancient forms of party strife. Ring in the nobler modes of life with sweeter manners, purer laws. Ring out the want, the care, the sin, the faithless coldness of the times. Ring out my mournful rhymes, but ring the fuller minstrel in. Ring out false pride and place and blood, the civic slander and the spite. Ring in the love of truth and right, ring in the common love of good. Ring out old shapes of foul disease, ring out the narrowing lust of gold. Ring in the thousand years of old, ring in the thousand years of peace. Ring in the valiant man and free, the larger heart, the kindlier hand. Ring out the darkness of the land, ring in the Christ that is to be.
Of course, it is to be expected that not all poets, nor indeed novelists, see the world exactly the same way. But leave it to Fyodor Dostoevsky, a Russian, to really throw a monkey wrench into our effort to avoid thinking too much about the inhumanity of our fellow man. Here's his classic, a short story entitled A Heavenly Christmas Tree. It might seem like it would put Elvis into his usual Christmas blue, blue, blue funk, but if you listen closely, you may hear something quite extraordinary, if not uplifting. It's read by Mark Wernke.
I'm a novelist, and I suppose I've made up this story. I write, I suppose, though I know for a fact that I made it up, but yet I keep fancying that it must have happened somewhere at some time, that it must have happened on Christmas Eve in some great town in a time of terrible frost. I have a vision of a boy, a little boy, 6 years old or even younger. This boy woke up that morning in a cold, damp cellar. He was dressed in a sort of little dressing gown and was shivering with cold. There was a cloud of white steam from his breath, and sitting on a box in the corner, he blew the steam out of his mouth and amused himself in his dullness watching it float away. But he was terribly hungry. Several times that morning he went up to the plank bed, where his sick mother was lying on a mattress as thin as a pancake, with some sort of bundle under her head for a pillow. How had she come here? She must have come with her boy from some other town and suddenly fallen ill. The landlady who let the corners had been taken 2 days before to the police station. The lodgers were out and about as the holiday was so near, and the only one left had been lying for the last 24 hours dead drunk, not having waited for Christmas. In another corner of the room, a wretched old woman of 80 who had once been a children's nurse but was now left to die friendless was moaning and groaning with rheumatism, scolding and grumbling at the boy so that he was afraid to go near her corner. He got a drink of water in the outer room, but could not find a crust anywhere, and had been on the point of waking his mother a dozen times. He felt frightened at last in the darkness. It had long been dusk, but no light was kindled. Touching his mother's face, he was surprised that she did not move at all, and that she was as cold as the wall. "It is very cold here," he thought. He stood a little, unconsciously letting his hands rest on the dead woman's shoulders. Then he breathed on his fingers to warm them, and then quietly fumbling for his cap on the bed, he went out of the cellar. He would have gone earlier, but was afraid of the big dog which had been howling all day at the neighbor's door at the top of the stairs. But the dog was not there now, and he went out into the street. Mercy on us, what a town! He had never seen anything like it before. In the town from which he had come, it was always such blackness at night. There was one lamp for the whole street. The little low-pitched wooden houses were closed up with shutters. There was no one to be seen in the street after dusk. All the people shut themselves up in their houses, and there was nothing but the howling of packs of dogs, hundreds and thousands of them barking and howling all night. But there it was so warm, and he was given food, while here, oh dear, if he only had something to eat. And what a noise and rattle here! What light, and what people, horses and carriages, and what a frost! The frozen steam hung in clouds over the horses, over their warmly breathing mouths, their hoofs clanged against the stones through the powdery snow, and everyone pushed so, and oh, how dear he longed for some morsel to eat, and how wretched he suddenly felt. A policeman walked by and turned away to avoid seeing the boy. Here was another street. Oh, what a wide one! Here he would be run over for certain, but everybody was shouting and racing and driving along, and the light, and what was this? A huge glass window, and through the window a tree reaching up to the ceiling. It was a fir tree, and on it were ever so many lights, gold papers and apples and little dolls and horses, and there were children clean and dressed in their best running about the room, laughing and playing and eating and drinking something. And then a little girl began dancing with one of the boys. What a pretty little girl! And he could hear the music through the window. The boy looked and wondered and laughed, though his toes were aching with cold, and his fingers were red and stiff so that it hurt him to move them. And all at once the boy remembered how his toes and fingers hurt him, and began crying, and ran on. And again through another window pane he saw another Christmas tree, and on a table cakes of all sorts, almond cakes, red cakes, and yellow cakes, and three grand young ladies were waiting there, and they gave the cakes to anyone who went up to them. And the door kept opening. Lots of gentlemen and ladies went in from the street. The boy crept up, suddenly opened the door, and went in. Oh, how they shouted at him and waved him back. One lady went up to him hurriedly and slipped a kopeck into his hand and with her own hands opened the door into the street for him. How frightened he was! And the kopeck rolled away and clinked upon the steps. He could not bend his red fingers to hold it tight. The boy ran away and went on, where he did not know. He was ready to cry again, but he was afraid, and ran on and blew on his fingers. And he was miserable because he felt suddenly so lonely and terrified, and all at once. Mercy on us! What was this again? People were standing in a crowd admiring. Behind a glass window there were three little dolls dressed in red and green dresses, and exactly as though they were alive. One was a little man sitting and playing a big violin. The others were standing close by and playing little violins and nodding in time and looking at one another, and their lips moved. They were speaking, actually speaking, only one couldn't hear through the glass. And at first the boy thought they were alive, and when he grasped that they were dolls, he laughed. He had never seen such dolls before, and he had no idea there were such dolls, and he wanted to cry, but he felt amused by the dolls. All at once, he fancied that someone caught at his smock behind. A wicked boy was standing beside him and suddenly hit him on the head, snatched off his cap, and tripped him up. The boy fell down on the ground at once. There was a shout, and he was numb with fright. He jumped up and ran away. He ran, and not knowing where he was going, he ran in at the gate of someone's courtyard and sat down behind a stack of wood. They won't find me here. Besides, it's dark. He sat huddled up and was breathless from fright, and all at once, quite suddenly, he felt so happy. His hands and feet suddenly left off aching and grew so warm as though he were on a stove. Then he shivered all over, then he gave a start. Why? He must have been asleep. How nice to have a sleep here. I'll just sit here a little and go and look at the dolls again, said the boy, and smiled, thinking of them, just as though they were alive. And suddenly he heard his mother singing over him. Mammy, I'm asleep. How nice it is to sleep here. Come to my Christmas tree, little one, a soft voice suddenly whispered over his head. He thought that this was still his mother, but no, it was not. Who was calling him? He could not see, but someone bent over and embraced him in the darkness, and he stretched out his hands to him, and all at once, oh, what a bright light! Oh, what a Christmas tree! And yet it was not a fir tree. He had never seen a tree like that. Where was he now? Everything was bright and shining, and all round him were dolls. But no, they were not dolls. They were little boys and girls, only so bright and shining. They all came flying around him. They all kissed him, took him, and carried him along with them. And he was flying himself, and he saw that his mother was looking at him and laughing joyfully. Mammy, oh, Mammy, how nice it is here, Mammy. And again he kissed the children and wanted to tell them at once of those dolls in the shop window. Who are you, boys? Who are you, girls? He asked, laughing and admiring them. This is Christ's Christmas tree, they answered. Christ always has a Christmas tree on this day, for the little children who have no tree of their own. And he found out that all these little boys and girls were children, just like himself, that some had been frozen in the baskets in which they had been as babies and had been laid on the doorsteps of well-to-do Petersburg people. Others had been boarded out with Finnish women by the foundling home and had been suffocated. Others had died at their starved mother's breasts in the Samara famine. Others had died in the third-class railway carriages from the foul air. And yet, they were all here. They were all like angels about Christ. And he was in the midst of them and held out his hands to them and blessed them and their sinful mothers. And the mothers of these children stood on one side weeping. Each one knew her boy or girl, and the children flew up to them and kissed them, and wiped away their tears with their little hands, and begged them not to weep, because they were so happy. And down below in the morning, the porter found the little dead body of the frozen child in the woodpile. They sought out his mother too. She had died before him. They met before the Lord God in heaven. Why have I made up such a story, so out of keeping with an ordinary diary and a writer's, above all? And I promised two stories dealing with real events. But that is just it. I keep fancying that all this may have happened really, that is, what took place in the cellar in the woodpile. But as for Christ's Christmas tree, I cannot tell you whether that could have happened or not.
Of course, not all is bleak, dark, or dreary by late December. Here's a short poem by Christine Rossetti, originally entitled A Christmas Carol. But most people, thanks to Dickens' heavy clout and appropriation of that title, simply call it by its first line. Here's Carol Peterson reading Rossetti's lyric.
In the bleak midwinter, frosty wind made moan. Earth stood hard as iron, water like a stone. Snow had fallen, snow on snow, snow on snow. In the bleak midwinter, long ago. Our God, heaven cannot hold him, nor earth sustain. Heaven and earth shall flee away when he comes to reign. In the bleak midwinter, a stable place sufficed the Lord God Almighty, Jesus Christ. Enough for him whom cherubim worship night and day, breast full of milk and a manger full of hay. Enough for him whom angels fall before, the ox and ass and camel which adore. Angels and archangels may have gathered there, cherubim and seraphim thronged the air. But his mother only, in her maiden bliss, worshipped the beloved with a kiss. What can I give him, poor as I am? If I were a shepherd, I would bring a lamb. If I were a wise man, I would do my part. Yet what I can, I give him. Give my heart.
Ah, now you're starting to get the picture. Christmas takes a bit of effort, and even those of us who haven't got much to give, well, what can it really cost us to give all our heart? Just ask Alfred Lord Tennyson, "'Tis better to have loved." Sometimes, though, there's no heavy lifting at Christmas. All we have to do is simply be present when life passes us by miraculously. Here's Jeff Bowman with a wonderfully short French story by Andrew Thurette entitled Christmas in the Forest.
Christmas Eve that year was bleak and cold, and the village seemed benumbed. The houses were closed hermetically, and so were the stables, from which came the muffled sound of animals. From time to time, the clacking of wooden shoes on the hardened ground resounded throughout the deserted streets. Then a door was hastily opened and closed, and all relapsed into silence. It was evident from the thick smoke rising through the chimneys into the gray air that every family was huddled around its hearth while the housewife prepared the Christmas supper. Stooping forward, with their legs stretched out to the fire, their countenances beamed with pleasure at the prospect of the morrow's festival and the foretaste of the fat and juicy blood sausages. The peasants laughed at the north wind that swept the roads, at the frost that powdered the trees of the forest, and the ice that seemed to vitrify the streams and the river. Following their example, my friend Tristan and I spent the livelong day in the old house of Abatiel at the corner of the hearth, smoking our pipes and reading poetry. At sundown, we had grown tired of seclusion and determined to venture out. "The forest must be a strange sight with this heavy frost," said I to Tristan. "Suppose we take a turn through the wood after supper. Besides, I must see the sabotiers, the makers of wooden shoes, from Corot about a little matter." So we pulled on our gaiters, stuffed our pipes, wrapped ourselves in our cloaks and mufflers, and headed into the wood. We walked along cheerfully over the rugged, hardened soil of the trenches, furrowed with deep frozen ruts. Through the copse on either side we saw mysterious white depths. After a damp night, the north wind had transformed the mists and vapors that overhung the branches into a tangle of snowy lace, and in the half-light of the gloaming we could still distinguish the sparkling needles of the junipers, the frosted puffs of the clematis, the bluish crystallizations of the beech, and the silver filigree of the nut trees. The silence was broken by the occasional creaking of the frozen limbs, and every now and then a breath of impalpable white dust dampened our cheeks as it melted there. We walked along at a steady pace, and in less than an hour caught sight of the red and flickering glow of the sabotiers' camp pitched on the edge of the forest above a stream that flowed down toward the valley of Saint-Ange. The settlement consisted of a spacious, cone-shaped, dirt-coated hut and a cabin with board walls carefully sealed with moss. The hut answered the combined purposes of dormitory and kitchen, and the cabin was used for the stowing away of tools and wooden shoes, and also for the two donkeys employed in the transportation of goods. The sabotiers, masters, apprentices, friends, and children were seated on beech logs around the fire in front of the hut, and their mobile silhouettes formed intensely black profiles against the red of the fire. Three short posts driven into the ground and drawn together at the top formed the crane, from which hung an iron pot that simmered over the coals. An appetizing odor of stewed hare escaped from the tin lid as it rose and fell under the puffs of vapor. The master, a lively, nervous, hairy little man, welcomed us with his usual cordiality. "Sit down and warm yourselves," said he. "You find us preparing the Christmas supper. I'm afraid we'll not sleep over soundly tonight. My old woman is ill. I fixed her a bed in the cabin where she'll be more comfortable and warmer on account of the animals. My boy has gone to Saint-Ange to get the doctor. There's no time to be lost. My little girl is kept busy running from the cabin to the hut." We had no sooner taken our seats around the fire than the snowflakes began to whirl about in the stillness above us. They fell so thick and fast that in less than a quarter of an hour we were compelled to protect the fire with a hurdle covered with sackcloth. "By my faith, gentlemen," said the sabotier, "you'll not be able to start out again in this storm. You'll have to stay and have your Christmas supper with us and taste of our stew." The weather was certainly not tempting, and we accepted the invitation. Besides, the adventure amused us, and we were delighted at the prospect of a Christmas supper in the heart of the forest. An hour later, we were in the hut, and by the light of a miserable little candle end, we had our Christmas supper, devouring our hare stew with a sharp appetite and washing it down with a draught of unfermented wine that scraped our throats. The snow fell thicker and thicker, wrapping the forest in a soft white wadding that deadened every sound. Now and then, the sabatier rose and went into the cabin, then came back looking worried, listening anxiously for the good woman from Saint-Ange. Suddenly, a few metallic notes, muffled by the snow, rose softly from the depth of the valley. A similar sound from an opposite direction rang out in answer. Then followed a third and a fourth, and soon a vague confusion of Christmas chimes floated over the woods. Our hosts, without interrupting the process of mastication, and while they passed around the wine jug, tried to recognize the various chimes by the fullness of the sounds. "Those now, those are the bells from Vevey. They are hardly any louder than the sound of the donkey's hooves on the stones. Ah, that is the bell of Auberive. Yes, and that peal that sounds like the droning of a swarm of beetles. That's the Grancy chimes." During this discussion, Tristan and I began to succumb to the combined action of warmth and fully satisfied appetite. Our eyes blinked, and before we knew it, we fell asleep on the moss of the hut, lulled by the music of the Christmas chimes. A piercing shriek, followed by a sound of joyful voices, woke us with a start. It had ceased snowing. The night was growing pale, and through the little skylight we could see above the fleecy trees a faint light in the sky, where a belated star hung quivering. "It's a boy!" shouted the master, bursting in upon us. "Gentlemen, if you think you would like to see him, why, I should be very glad, and it might bring him luck." We went crunching over the snow after him to the cabin, lighted by a smoky lamp. On her bed of lath and moss lay the young mother, weak and exhausted, her head thrown back, her pale face framed in by a mass of frowsy auburn hair. The good woman, assisted by the little girl, was bundling up the newcomer, who wailed feebly. The two donkeys, amazed at so much stir and confusion, turned their kindly gray faces toward the bed, shook their long ears, and gazed around them with wide, intelligent eyes, blowing through their nostrils puffs of warm vapor that hung like a thin mist on the air. At the foot of the bed stood a young shepherd, with a black and white she-goat and a newborn kid. "I have brought you the she-goat, Madame Fleuriot," said he in his languid drawl. "You can have her for the boy as long as you wish." The goat was bawling, the newborn child wailed, and the donkeys breathed loudly. There was something primitive and biblical about this whole scene. Without, in the violet light of the dawn, while a distant church bell scattered its early notes through the air, one of the young apprentices, dancing in the snow to keep warm, sang out at the top of his lungs that old Christmas carol, which seemed then full of new meaning and poetry.
Il est né la petite enfant, jouet, hautbois, raisin et musette. Il est né la petite enfant, chantant tout son événement.
That's a classic Christmas story few people seem to remember, or perhaps many of you have never heard of it before, so we thought it deserved to be included in this year's show. Up next, we have a short lyric that many of the local farmers have not forgotten and will know all about. It's Thomas Hardy's famous Christmas poem about a phenomenon among farm animals that many older people in our area still attest to with absolute certainty. And they say it happens only on Christmas night. Here's Brian Peterson with the oxen.
Christmas Eve and 12 of the clock. Now they are all on their knees, an elder said as we sat in a flock by the embers in a hearthside ease. We pictured the meek, mild creatures where they dwelt in their strawy pen. Nor did it occur to one of us there. No doubt they were kneeling then. So fair a fancy few would weave in these years, yet I feel, if someone said on Christmas Eve, "Come see the oxen kneel," and the lonely barton by yonder coombe our childhood used to know, I should go with him in the gloom, hoping it might be so.
We have another one of those classic Christmas short stories that strangely many people don't seem to either remember or know. It was written by Selma Lagerlöf, a Swedish writer who was the first woman to win the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1909. It's called O Holy Night and is read by Leslie Betts.
When I was 5 years old, I had such a great sorrow. I hardly know if I've had a greater since. It was then my grandmother died. Up to that time, she used to sit every day on the corner sofa in her room and tell stories. I remember that grandmother told story after story from morning till night, and that we children sat beside her quite still and listened. It was a glorious life. No other children had such happy times as we did. It isn't much that I recollect about my grandmother. I remember that she had very beautiful snow-white hair and stooped when she walked, and that she always sat and knitted a stocking. And I even remember that when she'd finished a story, she used to lay her hand on my head and say, "All of this is as true as that I see you and you see me." I also remember that she could sing songs, but this she did not do every day. One of the songs was about a knight and a sea troll and had this refrain, "It blows cold, cold weather at sea." Then I remember a little prayer she taught me and a verse of a hymn. Of all the stories she told me, I have but a dim and imperfect recollection. Only one of them do I remember so well that I should be able to repeat it. It is a little story about Jesus' birth. Well, this is nearly all that I can recall about my grandmother, except the thing which I remember best, and that is the great loneliness when she was gone. I remember the morning when the corner sofa stood empty, and when it was impossible to understand how the days would ever come to an end. That I remember, that I shall never forget. And I recollect that we children were brought forward to kiss the hand of the dead, and that we were afraid to do it. But then someone said to us that it would be the last time we could thank Grandmother for all the pleasure she had given us. And I remember how the stories and songs were driven from the homestead, shut up in a long black casket, and how they never came back again. I remember that something was gone from our lives. It seemed as if the door to a whole beautiful, enchanted world, where before we'd been free to go in and out, had been closed, and now there was no one who knew how to open that door. And I remember that little by little, we children learned to play with dolls and toys and to live like other children. And then it seemed as though we no longer missed our grandmother or remembered her. But even today, after 40 years, as I sit here and gather together the legends about Christ which I learned out there in the Orient, there awakes within me the little legend of Jesus' birth that my grandmother used to tell. And I feel impelled to tell it once again, and to let it also be included in my collection. It was a Christmas day, and all the folks had driven to church except Grandmother and I. I believe we were all alone in the house. We had not been permitted to go along because one of us was too old and the other was too young. And we were sad, both of us, because we'd not been taken to early Mass to hear the singing and to see the Christmas candles. But as we sat there in our loneliness, Grandmother began to tell a story. "There was a man," she said, "who went out in the dark night to borrow live coals to kindle a fire. He went from hut to hut and knocked. 'Dear friends, help me,' said he. 'My wife has just given birth to a child, and I must make a fire to warm her and the little one.' But it was way in the night, and all the people were asleep. No one replied. The man walked and walked. At last he saw the gleam of a fire a long way off. Then he went in that direction and saw that the fire was burning in the open. A lot of sheep were sleeping around the fire, and an old shepherd sat and watched over the flock. When the man who wanted to borrow fire came up to the sheep, he saw that three big dogs lay asleep at the shepherd's feet. All three awoke when the man approached and opened their great jaws as though they wanted to bark, but not a sound was heard. The men noticed that the hair on their back stood up and that their sharp white teeth glistened in the firelight. They dashed toward him. He felt that one of them bit at his leg and one at his hand and that one clung to his throat. But their jaws and teeth wouldn't obey them, and the man didn't suffer the least harm. Now the man wished to go farther to get what he needed, but the sheep lay back to back and so close to one another that he couldn't pass them. Then the man stepped upon their backs and walked over them and up to the fire, and not one of the animals awoke or moved. Thus far, Grandmother had been allowed to narrate without interruption, but at this point I couldn't help breaking in. "Why didn't they do it, Grandma?" I asked. "That you shall hear in a moment," said Grandmother, and went on with her story. When the man had almost reached the fire, the shepherd looked up. He was a surly old man who was unfriendly and harsh toward human beings. And when he saw the strange man coming, he seized the long spiked staff which he always held in his hand when he tended his flock and threw it at him. The staff came right toward the man, but before it reached him, it turned off to one side and whizzed past him far out in the meadow. When Grandmother had got this far, I interrupted her again. "Grandma, why wouldn't the stick hurt the man?" Grandmother did not bother about answering me, but continued her story. Now the man came up to the shepherd and said to him, "Good man, help me and lend me a little fire. My wife has just given birth to a child, and I must make a fire to warm her and the little one." The shepherd would rather have said no, but when he pondered that the dogs couldn't hurt the man, and the sheep had not run from him, and that the staff had not wished to strike him, he was a little afraid, and dared not deny the man that which he asked. "Take as much as you need," he said to the man. But then the fire was nearly burnt out. There were no logs or branches left, only a big heap of live coals, and the stranger had neither spade nor shovel wherein he could carry the red-hot coals. When the shepherd saw this, he said again, "Take as much as you need." And he was glad that the man wouldn't be able to take away any coals. But the man stooped and picked coals from the ashes with his bare hands and laid them in his mantle. And he didn't burn his hands when he touched them, nor did the coals scorch his mantle, but he carried them away as if they'd been nuts or apples. But here the storyteller was interrupted for the third time. "Grandma, why wouldn't the coals burn the man?" "That you shall hear," said Grandmother, and went on. And when the shepherd, who was such a cruel and hard-hearted man, saw all this, he began to wonder to himself, "What kind of a night is this when the dogs do not bite, the sheep are not scared, the staff does not kill, or the fire scorch?" He called the stranger back and said to him, "What kind of a night is this, and how does it happen that all things show you compassion?" Then said the man, "I cannot tell you if you yourself do not see it." And he wished to go his way that he might soon make a fire and warm his wife and child. But the shepherd did not wish to lose sight of the man before he had found out what all this might portend. He got up and followed the man till they came to the place where he lived. Then the shepherd saw that the man didn't have so much as a hut to dwell in, but that his wife and babe were lying in a mountain grotto, where there was nothing except the cold and naked stone walls. But the shepherd thought that perhaps the poor innocent child might freeze to death there in the grotto, and although he was a hard man, he was touched, and he thought he would like to help it. And he loosened his knapsack from his shoulder, took from it a soft white sheepskin, gave it to the strange man, and said that he should let the child sleep on it. But just as soon as he showed that he too could be merciful, his eyes were opened, and he saw what he had not been able to see before, and heard what he could not have heard before. He saw that all around him stood a ring of little silver-winged angels, and each held a stringed instrument, and all sang in loud tones that tonight the Savior was born who should redeem the world from its sins. Then he understood how all things were so happy this night that they didn't want to do anything wrong. And it was not only around the shepherd that there were angels, but he saw them everywhere. They sat inside the grotto, they sat outside on the mountain, and they flew under the heavens. They came marching in great companies, and as they passed, they paused and cast a glance at the child. There was such jubilation and such gladness and songs and play. And all this he saw in the dark night, whereas before he could not have made out anything. He was so happy because his eyes had been opened that he fell upon his knees and thanked God. Here Grandmother sighed and said, "What that shepherd saw, we might also see, for the angels fly down from heaven every Christmas Eve, if we could only see them." Then Grandmother laid her hand on my head and said, "You must remember this, for it is as true as that I see you and you see me. It is not revealed by the light of lamps or candles, and it does not depend upon sun and moon. But that which is needful is that we have such eyes as can see God's glory."
One of the most overlooked Canadian Christmas classics was written by Marjorie Pickthall in 1914. It's called The Worker in Sandalwood and tells the story of a simple boy who was employed as a cabinet maker's apprentice in rural Quebec near the end of the 19th century. Here it is, read by Lynn Stewart.
I like to think of this as a true story, but you who listen may please yourselves, siding either with the curé, who says Hyacinthe dreamed it all and did the carving himself in his sleep, or with Madame. I am sure that Hyacinthe thinks it is true, and so does Madame. But then she has the cabinet with the little birds and the lilies carved at the corners. Monsieur le curé shrugs his patient shoulders. But then he is tainted with the infidelities of cities, that good man, having been 3 times to Montreal and once in an electric car to St. Anne. He and Madame still talk it over whenever they meet, though it happened so many years ago, and each leaves the other forever unconvinced. Meanwhile, the dust gathers in the infinite fine lines of the little bird's feathers and softens the lily stamens where Madame's duster may not go. And the wood, aging, takes on a golden gleam as of immemorial sunsets, that pale red wood, heavy with the scent of the ancient East, the wood that Hyacinthe loved. It was the only wood of that kind which had ever been seen in Terminaison. Pierre Laurier brought it into the workshop one morning, a small, heavy bundle wrapped in sacking, and then in burlap, and then in soft, fine cloths. He laid it on a pile of shavings and unwrapped it carefully, and a dim sweetness filled the dark shed and hung heavily in the thin winter sunbeams. Pierre Laurier rubbed the wood respectfully with his knobby fingers. "It is sandalwood," he explained to Hyacinthe, pride of knowledge making him expansive. "A most precious wood that grows in warm countries, thou great goblin. Smell it, imbecile. It is sweeter than cedar. It is to make a cabinet for the old madame at the big house. Thy great hands shall smooth the wood, you nigaud, you simpleton. And I, Pierre, the cabinet maker, shall render it beautiful." And then he went out, locking the door behind him. When he was gone, Hyacinthe laid down his plane, blew on his stiff fingers, and shambled slowly over to the wood. He was a great clumsy boy of 14, dark-faced, slow of speech, dull-eyed and uncared for. He was clumsy because it is impossible to move gracefully when you are growing very big and fast on quite insufficient food. He was dull-eyed because all who met him did so unlovingly, and so he was uncared for, because none knew the beauty of his soul. But his heavy young hands could carve simple things, like flowers and birds and beasts, to perfection, as the curé pointed out. Simon has a tobacco jar, carved with pine cones and squirrels, and the curé has a pipe whose bowl is the bloom of a moccasin flower, that I have seen. But it is all very long ago, and facts, in those lonely villages, easily become transfigured, touched upon their grey with a golden gleam. "Thy hands shall smooth the wood, Nigaud, and I shall render it beautiful," said Pierre Laurier, and went off to drink brandy at the Cinque Chateaux. Hyacinthe knew that the making of the cabinet would fall to him, as most of the other work did. He also touched the strange, sweet wood, and at last laid his cheek against it, while the fragrance caught his breath. "How it is beautiful," said Hyacinthe, and for a moment his eyes glowed and he was happy. Then the light passed, and with bent head he shuffled back to his bench through a foam of white shavings curling almost to his knees. "Madame perhaps will want the cabinet next week, for that is Christmas," said Hyacinthe, and fell to work harder than ever, though it was so cold in the shed that his breath hung like a little silver cloud and the seal stung his hands. There was a tiny window to his right through which, when it was clear of frost, one looked on Terminaison, and that was cheerful and made one whistle. But to the left, through the chink of the ill-fitting door, there was nothing but the forest and the road dying away in it, and the trees moving heavily under the snow. Yet from there came all of Hyacinthe's dumb dreams and slow, reluctant fancies, which he sometimes found himself able to tell, in wood, but not in words. Brandy was good at the Cinque Chateaux, and Pierre Lauréat gave Hyacinthe plenty of directions, but no further help with the cabinet. "That is to be finished for Madame on the festival, gros escargot," said he, cuffing Hyacinthe's ears furiously. "Finished, and with a prettiness about the corners. Hearest thou, Orson? I suffer from a delicacy of the constitution, and a little feebleness in the legs on these days, so that I cannot handle the tools. I must leave this work to you, gâcheur, you blemish. See it is done properly, and stand up and touch a hand to thy cap when I address thee, Orvé, great slow worm." "Oh, yes, monsieur," said Hyacinthe wearily. It is hard, when you do all the work, to be cuffed into the bargain, and 14 is not very old. He went to work on the cabinet with slow, exquisite skill, but on the eve of Noel he was still at work in the cabinet unfinished. It meant a thrashing from Pierre if the morrow came and found it still unfinished, and Pierre's thrashings were cruel. But it was growing into a thing of perfection under his slow hands, and Hyacinthe would not hurry over it. "Then work on it all night and show it to me all completed in the morning, or thy bones shall mourn thine idleness," said Pierre with a flick of his little eyes. And he shut Hyacinthe into the workshop with a smoky lamp, his tools, and the sandalwood cabinet. It was nothing unusual. The boy had often been left before to finish a piece of work overnight while Pierre went off to his brandies. But this was Christmas Eve, and he was so very tired. The cold crept into the shed until the scent of the sandalwood could not make him dream himself warm, and the roof cracked sullenly in the frost. There came upon Hyacinthe one of those awful, hopeless despairs that children know. It seemed to be a living presence that caught up his soul and crushed it in black hands. "In all the world, nothing," said he, staring at the dull flame. "No place, no heart, no love. O kind God, is there a place, a love for me in another world? I cannot endure to think of Hyacinthe, poor lad, shut up, despairing in the workshop with his loneliness, his cold, and his hunger on the eve of Christmas. He was but an overgrown, unhappy child, and for unhappy children no aid at this season seems too divine for faith. So Madame says, and she is very old and very wise." Hyacinthe even looked at his chisel in his hand and thought that by a touch of that he might lose it all, and be at peace somewhere not far from God. Only it was forbidden. Then came the tears and great sobs that sickened and deafened him so that he scarcely heard the gentle rattling of the latch. At least, I suppose it came then, but it may have been later. The story is all so vague here, so confused with fancies that have spoiled the first simplicity. I think that Hyacinthe may have gone to the door, opening it upon the still woods and the frosty stars, and the lad who stood outside in the snow must have said, "I see you are working late, comrade. May I come in?" or something like that. Hyacinthe brushed his ragged sleeve across his eyes and opened the door wider with a little nod to the other to enter. Those little lonely villages strung along the great river see strange wayfarers adrift inland from the sea. Hyacinthe said to himself that surely here was such a one. Afterwards, he told the curé that for a moment he had been bewildered. Dully blinking into the stranger's eyes, he lost for a flash the first impression of youth and received one of some incredible age or sadness. But this also passed, and he knew that the wanderer's eyes were only quiet, very quiet, like the little pools in the wood where the wild doves went to drink. As he turned within the door, smiling at Jacinthe and shaking some snow from his fur cap, he did not seem more than 16 or so. "Oh, it is very cold outside," he said. "There is a big oak tree on the edge of the fields that has split in the frost and frightened all the little squirrels asleep there. Next year it will make an even better home for them. And see what I found close by." He opened his fingers and showed Jacinthe a little sparrow lying unruffled in the palm. "Pauvrette," said the dull Jacinthe. "Pauvrette, poor thing. Is it then dead?" He touched it with a gentle forefinger. "No," answered the strange boy, "it is not dead. We'll put it here, among the shavings not far from the lamp, and it will be well by morning." He smiled at Jacinthe again, and the shambling lad felt dimly as if the scent of the sandalwood had deepened and the lamp flame burned clearer. But the stranger's eyes were only quiet, quiet. "Have you come far?" asked Jacinthe. "It is a bad season for traveling, and the wolves are out in the woods." "A long way," said the other, "a long, long way. I heard a child cry." "Oh, but there is no child here," answered Jacinthe, shaking his head. "Monsieur Laureard is not fond of children. He says they cost too much money. But if you have come far, you must be cold and hungry, and I have no food nor fire. At the Cinque Chateaux you will find both." The stranger looked at him again with those quiet eyes, and Jacinthe fancied his face was familiar. "I will stay here," he said. "You are very late at work, and you are unhappy." "Well, why as to that?" answered Jacinthe, rubbing again at his cheeks and ashamed of his tears. "Most of us are sad at one time or another, the good God knows. Stay here and welcome, if it pleases you, and you may take a share of my bed, though it is no more than a pile of balsam boughs and an old blanket in the loft. But I must work at this cabinet, for this drawer must be finished, and the handles put on, and these corners carved, all by the holy morning, or my wages will be paid with a stick." "Oh, you have a hard master," put in the other boy, "if he would pay you with blows upon the feast of Noel." "Oh, he is hard enough," said Jacinthe, "but once he gave me a dinner of sausages and white wine, and once in the summer melons. If my eyes will stay open, I will finish this by morning, but indeed I am sleepy. Stay with me an hour or so, comrade, and talk to me of your wanderings, so that the time may pass more quickly." "Well, I will tell you of the country where I was a child," answered the stranger. And while Jacinthe worked, he talked of sunshine and of dust, of the shadows of vine leaves on the flat white walls of a house, of rosy doves on the flat roof, of the flowers that come in the spring, crimson and blue, and the white cyclamen in the shadow of the rocks, of the olive, the myrtle, and the almond, until Jacinthe's slow fingers ceased working and his sleepy eyes blinked wonderingly. "See what you have done, comrade," he said at last. "You have told of such pretty things that I have done no work for an hour, and now the cabinet will never be finished, and I shall be beaten." "Well, let me help you," smiled the other. "I was also bred a carpenter." At first Jacinthe would not, fearing to trust the sweet wood out of his own hands, but at length he allowed the stranger to fit in one of the little drawers, and so deftly was the work done that Jacinthe pounded his fist on the bench in appreciation. "You have a pretty knack," he cried. "It seemed as if you did but hold the drawer in your hands for a moment, and hey-ho, it jumped into its place." "Well, let me fit in the other little drawers while you go and rest a while," said the wanderer. So Jacinthe curled up among the shavings, and the stranger fell to work upon the little cabinet of sandalwood. And here begins what the curé will have is a dream within a dream. Sweetest of dreams was ever dreamed, if that is so. Sometimes I am forced to think with him, but again, as I see as clearly as with old Madame's eyes that have not seen the earthly light for 20 years, and with her and Jacinthe, I say credo. Jacinthe said that he lay among the shavings in the sweetness of the sandalwood and was very tired. He thought of the country where the stranger had been as a boy, of the flowers on the hills, of the laughing leaves of aspen and poplar, of the golden flowering anise and the golden sun upon the dusty roads, till he was warm. All the time through these pictures, as through a painted veil, he was aware of that other boy with the quiet eyes at work upon the cabinet, smoothing, fitting, polishing. He does better work than I, thought Jacynth, but he was not jealous. And again he thought, it is growing towards morning. In a little while I will get up and help him. But he did not, for the dream of warmth and the smell of the sandalwood held him in a sweet drowse. Also, he said that he thought the stranger was singing as he worked, for there seemed to be a sense of some music in the shed, though he could not tell whether it came from the other boy's lips, or from the shabby old tools as he used them, or from the stars. The stars are much paler, thought Jacynth, and soon it will be morning, and the corners are not carved yet. I must get up and help this kind one in a little moment. Only I am so tired, and the music and the sweetness seem to wrap me and fold me close so that I may not move. He lay without moving, and behind the forest there shone a pale glow of some indescribable color that was neither green nor blue, while in Terminaison the church bells began to ring. Day will soon be here, thought Jacynth, immovable in that deep dream of his, and with day will come Monsieur Lauriard and his stick. I must get up and help, for even yet the corners are not carved. But he did not get up. Instead, he saw the stranger look at him again, smiling as if he loved him, and lay his brown finger lightly upon the four empty corners of the cabinet. And Jacynth saw the little squares of reddish wood ripple and heave and break as little clouds when the wind goes through the sky. And out of them thrust forth little birds, and after them the lilies, for a moment living, but even while Jacynth looked, growing hard and reddish-brown and settling back into the sweet wood. Then the stranger smiled again, laid all the tools neatly in order, and opening the door quietly, went away into the woods. Jacynth lay still among the shavings for a long time, and then he crept slowly to the door. The sun, not yet risen, sent his first beams upon the delicate mist of frost afloat beneath the trees, as though all the world was aflame with splendid gold. Far away down the road a dim figure seemed to move amid the glory, but the glow and the splendor were such that Jacynth was blinded. His breath came sharply as the glow beat in great waves on the wretched shed, on the foam of shavings, and on the cabinet with the little birds and the lilies carved at the corners. He was too pure of heart to feel afraid. But, blessed be the Lord, whispered Hyacinth, clasping his slow hands, for he hath visited and redeemed his people. But who will believe? Then the sun of Christ's day rose gloriously, and the little sparrow came from his nest among the shavings and shook his wings to the light.
Our last short story, also by a Canadian, takes place in northern British Columbia. It was written 100 years ago in 1923 by Nellie McClung, a woman of considerable artistic talent, to say little of her ability to make political history in this country. It's read by Kathy Chepesky and is taken from McClung's 1923 novel, When Christmas Crossed the Peace.
By 2 o'clock on Christmas Day, people began to arrive with their provisions, and soon the long tables were set up and filled with roast turkeys, chickens, salads and jellies, cakes and pies. No one was gayer or happier than Mrs. Lukes, who had come over early with Madge to sweep out and see if the lamps were ready. "It's just like a dream," she cried happily to one of her neighbors. "It's just what I have been dreaming of, and I'm so happy I just feel I could fly. Just to know our children will have one real Christmas tree makes up for all we've come through." The tree, which the nurse and Bill Adams had finished dressing, stood on a big box, draped with the red shawl, on the stage, but it was not allowed to be seen until after supper. Although there were many adventurous young souls who crept forward to get a peek and came back shivering with delight. At 5 o'clock, dinner began. The men and women and small children sat in, while the big girls and boys waited on them, carrying plates of turkey and mashed potatoes and golden turnips from the reserves on the stove. Mrs. Lukes presided at the base of operations and made the coffee and cut the pies and was everywhere at once. At the proper moment, a hush fell on the audience, for the lamps were all turned low, and when the curtain was rolled back and the Christmas tree, ablaze with candles and sparklers, burst on the enraptured assemblage, there were little peals of delight and surprise from all over the hall. Dolls with golden hair, dolls with brown hair, stretched their arms appealingly to their little mothers in the audience, while from every branch a silver sparkler shot its white stars upward in a perfect frenzy of gladness. Balloons in red, green, and white tugged at their tie strings and threatened to fly to the roof, and the presence of balls and drums and engines and wagons and mysterious bundles and boxes below the tree set the young hearts dancing with expectation. When the supper was over and the last waiter had been fed, the nurse insisted that Bill Adams should speak to the people. "They are all asking who bought all these things, and you must tell them. It's only fair to all the men who contributed." Her eyes were dancing with mischief. "Sure, you must speak, Mr. Adams. Tell them about Christmas being the time when spirits blend and friend holds fellowship with friend and all that. That's good stuff. And about the pores of the heart being open and blessed be the tie that binds." Old Bill's eyes swept her face in keenest scrutiny. "Where did you hear that?" "Oh, that's the words of a hymn. You know it, I'm sure." There was no time for thought, for already the nurse was speaking, and a hush had fallen upon the happy company. "You will be wondering, dear friends, who our Santa Claus is tonight, who has made all this happiness possible. We have him here behind the curtain, and now I'm going to introduce to you one of our oldest and best-known settlers, Mr. William Adams." Too much surprised even to applaud, the people sat, and old Bill came forward. Under Miss Crawford's persuasion, he had bought a new suit and had indulged in a shave and haircut, and the gasp of astonishment which broke from the people was a sincere tribute to his improved appearance. "Dear friends," he said, "it's a long time since I've made a speech. Many years have fallen on my speech-making ability, years and other things. But tonight is Christmas, and the spirits of Christmas are abroad and make us do queer things, things we did not intend to do. Queer things, but things which make us happy, too. I don't half understand all this myself, and I don't know why I am here. But," here he straightened up and began to expand like a dried Japanese water flower that feels the life-giving water beneath it, "it's only fair to the boys who chipped in on this to tell you that a bunch of us got talking about Christmas a while back, and it being a time for a little jollification, and this year," he stumbled a little here, but the glowing faces before him gave him courage, "this year it seemed best to spread it out and make the fun reach over all the people. It seemed best. In fact, we were led that way by an invisible hand, as it were, and we sure all hope you are enjoying it and that everybody is as pleased as I am. I never knew that a person could feel as good as this without taking anything. It's a new one on me, but I hope you are all happy. I sure am." Cheers and wildest applause broke out then, and cries of, "You bet we are. Good old boy, Bill. You're all right." And when it had subsided, another thrill came from behind the tree, and hidden by it, the big square phonograph, with its doors opened wide, burst into song. "Hark the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn King, peace on earth and mercy mild, God and sinners reconciled. It sang in the silvery tones of the Welsh quartet, sang it in words so clear and triumphant that on its strong wings of melody, tired souls were borne upward to the very gates of heaven. "It's the singers from Wintering Hills," someone gasped. "It must be." But Mrs. Lukes pressed her rough hands together convulsively. "Now," she cried happily, "it's Christmas. It's a real Christmas with God in it. It has crossed the peace. It has come over to us. My dream has come true. I'm satisfied." And from her eyes, the staring loneliness had all gone, and in their depths had dawned a great new hope of better things to come. While the tree was being unloaded and the fun was at its height, the nurse slipped away with a great basket of provisions for her patient. "I'm neglecting you," she said, "but oh, the things I have to tell you when it is over. I can't let you go to the hospital at the crossing tomorrow. I won't be through telling you. I'm going to bring old Bill home with me. I'll leave the teapot here where you can reach it. Now chew your food well. Isn't that a great brand of lemon pie? Keep your mind from worry, and if you feel the need of further instructions, consult Diana here beside you." She was gone in a moment, and in spite of the two lamps turned high, for him the room had grown dark. "Come right in, Mr. Adams," he heard her saying at the door. "Come right in. You've never seen my little house, have you? Oh, no, I'm never lonely. You see, sometimes I have a patient for a few days. My private ward is over there behind the curtain. Yes, indeed, I like your idea for weekly meetings in the hall. Now with the phonograph and so many ready to help, we can have all sorts of good times. Hang your coat here, Mr. Adams. I would like you to meet my patient. He cannot get out of bed, so will you please come this way?" Throwing back the curtain in front of the dispensary, the light fell full on the laughing face of Sergeant Woods. "Mr. Adams, meet Sergeant Woods," said the nurse calmly.
Haven't we met before?" said the old man, trying to recover his composure.
"Yes," said the sergeant, smiling. "You very kindly picked me up on Bricks Hill. You and your friend Dad Peters brought me here 2 days ago."
"But you didn't stay here," exclaimed his visitor. "Ever since, haven't I, nurse?"
"For the very good reason," said the nurse, "that his leg is in splints." The old man looked from one to the other helplessly and sat down hard in the chair the nurse had placed for him.
"Then who the devil did I see? And who was it that..."
"That what, Mr. Adams?" asked the nurse, with more eagerness than regard for sentence construction.
"See here," burst from the old man, "did you break your leg or did you not?"
"I did."
"Well, why did you tell me you didn't, and that it was all in the game to throw me off the track? And why did you wave it round to show me it was all right?"
The sergeant looked at the nurse with lifted eyebrows. "Oh, nurse," he said.
"I didn't wave it," said the nurse quietly. "I did not need to wave it. You could tell it couldn't be broken. No one could ride 40 miles with a broken leg, could they?" "See here," said the old man desperately. "Who held me up at the point of a revolver in a dark corner at the crossing and took $500 from me?"
"I didn't," spoke up the policeman. "I have been here all the time with a broken leg." Looking from one to the other, the old man slowly began to nod his head. Then he arose and, making a sweeping bow to the nurse, he said, "Miss Downey, once again I offer you my hand in marriage." With equal dignity, Miss Downey replied, "And once again I decline the honor." There was a silence in the room, broken only by the thumping of Tinkerbell's tail on the floor as she registered applause.
"Young man," said Mr. Adams, addressing the radiant face on the pillow, Young man, there's one awful lesson in this for you and me. We're poor fish, us men. We have a rough way of doing things. Your way was to arrest me, seize the stuff, send me to jail. That's no damn good. I'd be swearing my soul away in jail, boys all mad, everything in a mess. Look at this girl. She skins my roll, but look what she does with it. What she does with me. She scrubbed me, shaved me, first in my own house, then on the public highway, robbed me, but made me the best liked man in the neighborhood. Makes everyone think so well of me, I think well of myself. I'm not old Bill Adams the bootlegger. I'm the man who brought the Christmas treat to the kids. She spoils my taste for booze, this girl, and has given me a taste for my fellow men. Tonight coming out, I met a bunch of the boys who gave me the money, Dad Peters, Bill Lukes, and the rest. They grabbed my hand and said, "All right, old man, glad you done it." They feel better. I feel better. Everyone in the settlement feels better. She did it all. She and your revolver. Mr. Adams, said the nurse, taking the old man's hand in both of hers, you're wrong about the revolver. It was only a flashlight I used, and remember, the suggestion was yours about buying things for the kids. You said it first. That gave me the idea. I saw it was the way out, and it has all been so fine. You played up well, too, Mr. Adams, and we'll never give it away. He turned to the bed and shook hands with the sergeant. You remember what I said, sergeant, about a man alone being a poor stick. Profit by it. Not but that I'm willing to admit that as men go. You're some man. When Bill Adams was gone, she came back to her patient and in her best hospital manner beat up his pillows. I'm getting better, nurse, he said hopefully. I'm feeling better every minute. Well, she said, about tomorrow I will feel well enough to... She interrupted him quickly. It may interest you to know that nurses never accept proposals from their patients. He knitted his brows and looked at her. When will you take me to the hospital? He asked after a pause. Tomorrow. I would keep you here, but I may be called away any minute. And I won't be your patient then? No. But you will come to see me? Yes. But nurse, no one can propose to a girl when he doesn't know her first name. That doesn't matter, she said, north of the peace. And outside, right above the little house, the northern lights, pink and green and violet and amber, marched and flamed and danced and looped, folding and shooting and darting, just as if they knew and were glad.
So, there you have it. Enough food for thought to perhaps move anyone out of a tailspin towards Christmas doom and gloom, if not a blue, 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 blue Christmas. But before we go, there's one little poem left, a bit of icing on the figurative Christmas cake we've been baking for you. It was written 101 years ago in 1922 by a great British philosopher and novelist, G.K. Chesterton. It's called, you guessed it, A Christmas Carol.
The Christ child lay on Mary's lap. His hair was like a light. Oh, weary, weary were the world, but here is all right. The Christ child lay on Mary's breast. His hair was like a star. Oh, stern and cunning are the kings, but here the true hearts are. The Christ child lay on Mary's heart. His hair was like a fire. Oh, weary, weary is the world, but here the world's desire. The Christ child stood on Mary's knee. His hair was like a crown, and all the flowers looked up at him, and all the stars looked down.
We hope you enjoyed our show and hope you spend the next day or two, if not the whole week, simply enjoying the boisterous, bustling life around you. And whether the weather outside turns frightful or the season is tinged with blue, green, or white, whatever you're celebrating, if anything, in these dark and dreary days of bleak midwinter, we hope you still take time to cherish the people near and dear to you, as we do our beloved Opyongo Readers Theater. I'm Kristen Marchand, and along with that theater troupe and our producer, Barry Conway, we'd like to wish you the best of the season and many happy returns. That is, once old St. Nick finally scurries back up the chimney. Good day, and God bless.